Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. You're listening, and you'll be listening all night to a CD called Solophone, Chicago Soul Jazz Collective. But mostly you'll be listening to people talk. It's a great lineup of guests, and the first of those is my dear old friend. I know other photographers out there are listening, and so you will understand that Wes Pope and Kevin Horan and Fred Stein and all you other photographers that I say right now that Charles Osgood is the greatest newspaper photographer in the history of newspapers. Hi, Charlie.
Well, hello, Rick Hogan. And I've got my Rick Hogan voice tonight, too. So.
What's that?
Well, whatever this thing is that I've got.
Are you sick? Are you just getting old?
Yeah, one of the two, or maybe both.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Charlie and I, as many of you may know, collaborated on the column called Sidewalks, which was a kind of a photo and word collaboration that lasted for how many?
13 years.
Wow. Yeah. 13 years and two books.
Yeah, and you're still going. You're still going strong with it.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Twice a week.
That's true, sadly. Yeah, before it used to only be once a week. Those were the glory days. Let me ask you first, Charlie, before we start talking about your book, which I think is an amazing, you know, it's funny, and you know this, that, you know, a couple of months ago, Wes Pope was in here, former Tribune photographer, now a teacher in Oregon, and he has a book about, you know, shooting Route 66 with a pinhole camera.
Right.
And then Kevin Horan, a former local photographer, very good one, was in here with a book about goats and sheep.
It's a great book. It is so fun.
It is a pretty amazing book. And here you are with Dutch Love. But do you miss newspapering? I mean, newspapering has changed so dramatically.
Well, I mean, working for the Trib is like, you know, it's a second family for one thing. So you know everybody, but also you're on top of the news. You get the news first, so it's really neat.
Where do you get your news now? You don't get news.
Yeah, what's that?
You get it from Donald Trump's tweets, do you?
What else is there? Yeah.
Well, since you left the Tribune, you've had a very sort of very active freelance career, still shooting a lot of theater and dance companies in Chicago.
But well, in fact, last night, I did Pete Seeger's 100th birthday party put together by Michael Miles.
Yeah, Michael Miles, who was sitting in that chair 1 week ago today.
Right?
Yes, and I couldn't go. I wrote about it last week, and Michael has been a great friend of mine. How was it?
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I'll bet.
That guy is a genius. I mean, he writes everything. He writes all the music. He writes all the text.
But don't you find
for 11 people?
But don't you find the amazing thing about Michael's shows is he did one some time ago that you went to and shot called America 1968.
Yes.
And as I'm leaving the theater, I was part of the show. People are saying, "Oh my God, I can't wait to bring Uncle Bernie and my whole family here next week." And I'm going, "No, that's it. It's a one-time only thing." That I think is one of the most astonishing things about
it. Right. He would like to do this more. This particular show, he would like, but right now there's nothing in the works.
Yeah, that's too bad. So you were still very, very, very active, and Charlie wanted to make sure that he was working last night. He was working at the Old Town School last night.
And I was just over at Ethel Polk's 102nd birthday party.
Oh, my God. He's busier than I am. Dutch Love is a work of, I think, intense research. It is a beautiful, beautiful book. I mean, I'm going to talk to you about who designed it and put it together for you. But what's the seed of this book, Charlie?
Well, my sister gave me a journal that my great-aunt had written in 1914. She took a trip to Europe just before the start of World War I, and she did a handwritten journal. Collected postcards, hand-colored postcards, and then when she came home, she typed up the journal and rewrote it and did carbon copies. I don't know how many she made, but anyway, I got a copy of one of the carbon copies, and my sister Mary said, "Wouldn't it be great to go back to Europe and follow her path 100 years later in 2014.
And you were absolutely taken with that idea.
Oh, I love the idea, yeah. She wasn't able to go, but, you know.
Did you go on your own or with?
Yeah, no, I went on my own.
Of your many girlfriends over the years, mostly on your own.
I put a bet that girlfriends.
Did you do it though with the notion? I don't think you did, as I recall. You didn't do it with the notion of creating a book about it. You did it.
Not necessarily. It wasn't that the idea hadn't come to me. It's just that in order to do a book, if I was going there in advance to do a book, I would have tried to go to every place at the same time of year as my Aunt Winifred, great Aunt Winifred did. And I just couldn't do it. It was impossible for me to do it. I was having my first grandchild born in the middle of it.
Right.
My daughter would not have talked to me, you know, things like that.
What did your great-aunt Winifred do that she could take a trip like this?
She was the director of a social agency in Chicago called the Association House, which, curiously, I went to for the first time 2 weeks ago.
What is it?
I didn't know it still existed. Well, it's just like Hull House, and she worked with Jane Addams.
Wow.
This is back in, I think she was the head of the Association House from 1914 to 1922. So anyway, she was going to Europe, not only to see Europe and do all the tourist stuff, but also to kind of look into the prison system and the poorhouses and get an idea of where her clients were coming from. You know,
wow, how fascinating.
Give a little background, yeah.
Wow, wow. We got to take a break. Charlie's going to be here all the way till about 1:45. I will tell you, so please stay tuned. Okay. The CD is called Solophone, Chicago Soul Jazz Collective. My guest is called Chuck Charlie, or Charles Osgood. He's the great former Tribune photographer with whom I collaborated for many, many years. His new book includes none of my writing, and it's as a result, it's a spectacular, spectacular book called Dutch Love. He will be signing and talking about the book this Wednesday at the bookseller on Lincoln Avenue in the heart of Lincoln Square, a great bookstore. In large part because Susie Takas, who runs it, is an estimable bookseller and human being, and they serve wine and beer there. That's
even better.
Yeah, even better. You can buy this book.
No bourbon?
But
no bourbon?
They may slip in some for you. You still drinking bourbon at your advanced age?
Maybe not so much.
Rick, I'm not really that much. When on your journey, and you were retracing your great aunt Winifred's footsteps in 1914 as she went to Europe to kind of investigate the social movement a la Hull House and her place, when did it start to take shape that this might be a book? What did you find there? What was your first revelation?
Well, the interesting thing is that when I first got to Europe, I went to Paris and I stayed with old friends of mine. And I left a copy of Winifred's text with them. And then I stayed with them again on the way out of Europe. And they said, you have got to publish this. This is, the whole world should read this.
Wow.
So I thought, well, that's pretty.
You thought, well, it's not just me who likes it; somebody else.
Oh, she's such a wonderful writer. I mean, I hesitated to try to write anything.
Give me an example, Charlie. You don't have to read anything, but I mean, she was. These are observations of the various places she went,
She saw and her descriptions. The lapis lazuli ocean on the Amalfi Coast. The Amalfi Coast is a place where you can't stop taking pictures because it's so beautiful. She said it much better than I do. I could read it, but then I'd have to look it up, and that would take time.
Why do you think she saved all this stuff?
Well, I don't know. That's a really good question. It's partly a family thing. Family's got a whole history of writing journals and keeping diaries and then handing them down through the years. But in this case, she hand wrote the journal initially, came back, typed it up, did a really wonderful job rewriting it, and then made carbon copies. So I assume it wasn't that common for people that she knew to go to Europe. And so this was her way of, you know, letting them in on her vacation.
She traveled by herself?
She traveled with four other women in a group, but she had a very close friend named Alice, which reappears throughout the story. Alice?
Oh, Alice. So, wait, there were four women. She was part of a group of four women.
So there were five women total.
And Alice would come and go? Or
what? Well, no, but she would
Alice
room with Alice.
Alice is a great mystery woman.
Alice, I know she is a mystery woman. You know, she roomed with Alice, and then there were some older women. I think she was 34. She turned 34 on the trip. And so I assume Alice was somewhere around the same age.
How long was she going? Yeah, the other interesting thing about it is this is a continent on the brink of war.
Yes, and I'm wondering, I mean, my grandfather went at the same time. He went in 1914. He was Swedish, Swedish immigrant, and hadn't been home for 20 years. So he went the same year. And the only thing I can think of is that the clouds of war were hovering over Europe, and they wanted to go, and if they didn't go now, when would they go? But that's a guess on my part.
What'd your grandfather do?
He was a wonderful tailor in Evansville, Wisconsin. He had wanted to be a carpenter, but in Sweden there were too many carpenters, so he couldn't be that. So he became a tailor, and he's a terrific tailor.
What always amazes me about, and your book is of a kind, of these kind of, you know, travelogues, personal travelogues, written not as, you know, commercial books, but as kind of things to share within a family. What always amazes me about it is it was a grand adventure. It was not easy to travel around in that era, was it?
Each of their trips was 11 weeks, and that includes 2 weeks just coming and going. The cruise over was about 8 days. And so then they each had 9 weeks over there. Now, the interesting thing about both of their trips is that she was coming back and he was going over, so there were ships passing in the Atlantic Ocean on June 28th. Which was the day that the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated.
Yeah, starting
World War One.
You know, this is just 2 years after the sinking of the Titanic,
right,
too,
right.
1912. Did you get a sense, you must have, in putting the book together and reading and rereading what she wrote, you must have been able to get a real sense of her.
Yeah, what she was interested in, she loved flowers, and so she's always writing about flowers. Wherever she went to see these gorgeous gardens that they have around luxury homes in Europe, and then she'd write about those and describe all the colors. So that if it wasn't flowers, and she was into artists, she described all these wonderful artists and paintings that she saw. She said she saw the giant painting by Titian in the Doge Palace in Venice, and she said that's the largest painting in the world, which I think, I don't know if it still is.
It might still be.
I think
yeah.
It's the largest painting painted by one person.
What did you know about her before you came upon all of this stuff? Was she just a sort of shadowy relative figure?
Not at all. No, I grew up knowing her. So she died when I was like 22.
Oh, okay.
So I would go
visit
her.
What did you think of her? Did you know her as
a... Oh, she was a real sweet lady. Yeah, I liked her a lot.
But this must
And
have...
she had cats. And
right,
I liked
like
cats.
Like a dozen cats?
She actually lived with two other people. So in a motel near Evansville, Wisconsin, called Silo Acres.
Wow. Now, what's your next book about Wisconsin? Let me ask you, before we take a break and get some commercials, and then I want to talk about how this book came to be, what is Dutch Love? What's that mean?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Is it just a snappy title, or what's it all about?
Well, right here, I have a copy of a letter that my grandfather wrote to his family. Now, when he was in Europe, he was in Sweden, and he'd had this family reunion with his mother and nine siblings. And 2 days after that, on July 28th, war was declared. So that kind of messed up his vacation.
He would think, yes.
And a lot of other people's vacations. So he had to figure out how to get back because the countries were confiscating all the tour ships,
yeah,
cruise ships that took these people over. So according to the Evansville Review, in 1914, there were 300,000 Americans tourists in Europe.
Stuck in Europe?
All scrambling to get back on fewer ships. Now, I've never seen that documented any other place.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, but I don't know how they all get back. Now, he was in Scandinavia, and he was able to get a ship back, and he landed in New York in September. So he wrote this letter to his family, dated September 3rd, 1914. My dear family, this is my second day in New York, and it's hotter than Dutch Love. What the heck is Dutch Love?
So have you researched this whole Dutch Love thing?
Yeah, it didn't take just long. Based, I just Googled
Dutch I know, Love. But I'm just saying, based on just the title and what you have just read now, this could become a monster bestseller. I think
well, that's what I was thinking.
Just based on that. You're a genius at titling books.
On the other hand, when I tell people my book's about, is called Dutch Love, they say, oh, I'm Dutch. Oh, this would be great. I'd love it. But it's got very little to do with it.
There's a huge untapped market out there. Charles Osgood, my dear, dear friend and the great Tribune photographer and still photographing all manner of things in and around Chicago. His book is Dutch Love. He'll be at the bookseller Wednesday night at 7, and he will be back talking after the news and a couple commercials. Solo Phone, Chicago Soul Jazz Collective. I have a few more minutes of my dear friend Charles Osgood, the great former Tribune photographer, still taking pictures all over the place. He was shooting that Pete Seeger celebration put on by Michael Miles last night at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and he's here talking about his fabulous book, Dutch Love, which is, you have to buy it to fully understand the meaning of Dutch Love. But it is a magnificent book. It's a sort of full-sized book which reproduces many of the letters and photographs. And Charlie, it's a beautiful book. I mean, the book itself is like a work of art.
Yes, thank you very much. I had all these old pictures, and my first designer put them all together on the cover and on the back of it. And it's so hard to know. Are you going to, when you do comparisons, are you going to put the paragraph when we're both in Berlin,
right,
and put them right next to each other? And that seemed like it would be incredibly confusing and complicated, and I'd never get it done. So then I said, the heck with that. I'm just going to publish their journals exactly the same size as I found them, as I got them, with the yellow pages and the frayed edges and everything. So,
well, and your own writing and your journal, too. And, I mean, this is an extraordinary gathering, this book called Dutch Love, that, you know, if you can make it Wednesday, it's supposed to, as Roger had been telling us, raining, so good time to stay indoors, Wednesday night at 7 at the bookseller in the heart of Lincoln Square. It's a great, great independent bookstore. You can also just get in touch with the bookseller and order the book, you know, from them. Yeah. And you're not, you know, no one's going to make, Charlie and I have been involved in a couple of publishing ventures before, and we know full well that no one's going to get rich off book publishing, the book publishing business. But it's a remarkable kind of document. Winifred would be, all of your family would be really proud of you. Are you really proud of this book?
I am proud of the book. I've really had a lot of support from various people, the designers, Diane Burgess, was the second designer. She came in last fall, former Tribune designer.
Everybody's a former Tribune employee except me, and I will be, and I certainly will be one day, that's for sure. You love talking about this, too, don't you? You're going to read, I'm assuming you'll read some excerpts at the bookseller on Wednesday night.
I don't know. Do you think I should read?
Yes, I do.
With this voice?
Yes.
See, what I was thinking is
you should
have
a radio show.
I would give the book.
You should have your own radio show, the Dutch Love Hour.
Yeah, well, I was thinking I would have the audience do the reading. Like, for example, I'd have Rick Kogan read, you know, just open the book anywhere, point, and then start reading.
Well, I'll do the audiobook version of Dutch Love. That's what I aspire to. Charlie, I'm really proud of you. I miss you tremendously and what we had as collaborators at the Tribune doing the Sidewalks column in the old days of the magazine. Are you going to do anything at Printer's Row Book Festival about this?
I don't have any plans to. If you
you should don't. Tribune is not intimately involved as much as it was before.
Right, right.
But let me see what I can do because that would be fun. I think you should do that.
It's a good promo time for Printer's Row. When is it?
June 7th and 8th, I think.
Okay.
Unless you'll be on one of your world jaunts,
I'll be free. I'll be available.
Charlie, it's great to see you, honey.
Good to see you.
Take care of yourself. Again, the book is Dutch Love. Charlie will be talking about it and Charles Osgood will Wednesday night at 7 at the bookseller in the heart of Lincoln Square. You can, the bookseller's got a nice website. Just if you want the book and can't go, yes, sir.
I was just going to say, I'm going to be in conversation with Michelle Gavin, who is an avid traveler herself and a former student of mine, and she gave me the names of various people I could stay with on my trip throughout Europe. So it'll be a nice little back
and forth. It's only one of the few ways in which Osgood and Kogan differ. Charlie loves to stay with other people, and I hate it. I love hotels. I wouldn't stay with someone if they got down on their hands and knees and bait me. I feel like I'm putting them out. I love hotels. Charlie loves to stay
with friends. I love putting people out. Yeah,
you do not. You love friends. You love friends. All right, sweetie, I'll see you soon.
Okay.
All right. We're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back and talk about a place that Charles Osgood has taken photos of many times, a place called Givens Castle in the heart of Beverly. The history of that remarkable place and the effort to save it because it is in some danger of, I suppose, I'm looking at Roberta Chalmers, of falling down. I think it is in danger of falling down, and it's one of Chicago's grand buildings. So we'll be back in a couple minutes. Dan Long, the great engineer of this thing, we were saying to each other, well, who knows what the CD is going to be like. It's actually pretty good, don't we agree, Dan? It's called Solophone, Chicago Soul Jazz Collective. And I am a big believer that a city has a soul, and it has a soul in large part, not just because of the people who live in that city, but because of some of the buildings in that city. And one of my favorite buildings, I am not a child of Beverly, the Beverly neighborhood. But I certainly talk and write enough about Beverly to be an adopted child of the neighborhood. Givens Castle is one of the most unusual buildings, certainly in this town and anywhere in the Midwest. And I've got to talk about it. Roberta Chalmers and Errol Magidson. Errol's been on the show before talking about his you know, exhaustive book. I mean, this book is astonishing. Chicago's Only Castle, The History of Givens Castle and Its Keepers. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Now, I said before that the castle's in some danger, not perhaps of crumbling, but it needs help, doesn't it?
It does.
Roberta, how are you involved?
I am a member of the church that uses
Occupies,
the castle.
Yeah.
And I am a property manager by trade, so I offered to help with the restoration. The first issue that we had was a crack on the turrets, and that kind of led to the discovery of many more issues.
Errol, you've been in love with this building from the time that you were driving around, I think, with your your late wife, and you stopped at the corner, and you looked up, and you saw
this thing. I saw this medieval castle. It looked
and
like
it changed
a real
your life.
Castle.
I mean, that stop sign changed your life.
I decided to live in the neighborhood and actually became a part of what was a group called Men of the Castle for many years.
Talk a little before we get into it, because you guys are going to be on all the way till another 40 minutes or so. The history of the place is fascinating to me.
Well, it certainly was fascinating to me. I mean, there were five different groups there, including three families. Robert C. Givens was the founder. It was his inspiration that had the castle built in 1886 and 1887. Legend has it that he saw a castle in Ireland, and that was the inspiration. But that, of course, is a legend. We don't really know.
Well, another great legend about Givens, and I would know nothing about this castle if it weren't for these people in the studio with me. And everything I've learned from them has increased my fascination. Givens arrived in Chicago as a teenager in 1863 with 10 cents in his pocket. Right. And a distinguished lineage in his native Canada. He got into the real estate game.
Yes.
And did well.
Oh, he did tremendously well. He was responsible for a lot of the homes and lots that were here in the Chicago area, including the suburbs. And, of course, when he came here, much of Chicago was much smaller than what it is today. There was much annexation that took place over the years when he was here. And he was responsible for selling lots and made a fortune. And
you do think that when he built the castle, that one of the reasons he owned a lot of property in the area. It's like Potter Palmer building, you know, Palmer's castle to help increase the land values of what is now the Gold Coast. What's your theory on his? I mean, obviously, he built himself a fine home, but it also, he did it to help get other people to buy fine homes in the area, right?
I don't know that that's true. Some people believe that. He definitely wanted to live away from the hustle and bustle of the downtown area at the time. Everybody wants their home to be their castle, in a sense. And
sure.
I'm not so sure. He didn't need to make money off of that.
Yeah,
I mean, he had
yeah.
plenty. And so he was instrumental throughout Chicago of selling lots, and he was a founder of the Chicago Real Estate Board,
right?
And also at one time the vice president of that organization, which is now the Chicago Association of Realtors, something like that.
Roberta Chalmers, are you a child of Beverly?
I live very close to the castle. I'm not in Beverly, but very.
Did
close.
Did you grow up there?
No.
Where'd you grow up?
Kind of all over, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. D.C., Kansas City, Corpus Christi, Texas.
Were your father in the Air Force or something?
No, but my parents were just kind of liked to change, so we went all over.
What is it about? So when did you move? When did you first see the castle?
About 4 years ago.
What did you think?
I loved it, and I wanted to know the history of it.
Yeah,
because
it just begs.
Yes.
It should have, you know, some in neon, hey, do you want to know what this is?
Exactly.
Come inside.
It's interesting you say that, because we actually offer monthly castle tours now.
When did that start? I know you did it a while ago and then stopped. stopped.
And we restarted it in April, actually. It will be ongoing the third Sunday of every month at 1, but because April was, third Sunday was Easter, we did it on the 4th. Yeah. But going forward, it'll be third Sunday.
And who's going to those?
We have neighborhood, community residents who are interested in learning more or seeing the inside, because everybody wants to see the inside of a castle.
Sure.
So community members, people who are visiting from out of town, family members that live nearby, bring them.
Yeah. You know, you do, aside from, Errol, you can get in on this too, aside from the regular church activities, you have, I mean, John Devins, the great folk entrepreneur, has been on the show a number of times. He's been having concerts there and at the Heritage Gallery just up the street.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a difficult thing to sort of kick up the number of public events, isn't it? It's hard, isn't it?
So-so. We're limited mostly by space. So the public events that we have need to be on the smaller scale, but I mean, it's big enough to hold a good size event. So,
few people
in there.
And Irma Eggenson, talk to me about the affection, you being relatively, and I mean relatively new to Beverly and seeing it when you were stopped at that corner. The people in Beverly have a deep, whether they attend services there or not, have a deep affection for that place because many of them went to preschool there. Many of them bought their Christmas trees there. Could you talk about that? What a firm part of that community this place is.
Well, the fact is that there's the Castle Academy that's been there for a good number of years, actually, since about 1960, although that wasn't the original name. But many children in the neighborhood actually went to that non-sectarian school, and they would call the building fondly my castle or the castle, and so they have lots of fond memories.
Especially a Christmas tree thing.
Oh,
too.
Yeah.
Oh.
We do the Christmas tree sales.
Yeah. Yep. So when you, Roberta, started to get involved and you are professionally a building manager,
mm-hmm.
And it was discovered that, well, maybe this building needs a little bit more than, you know, spackle here and there. How did the organization to save it come about?
Well, I mentioned earlier we found a crack on the
right.
turret, and that kind of started an investigation on how deep it really went. And as they had some engineers come out and get into the sorts of issues, it became a much bigger issue. So we had an engineering study done to tell us all of the details of what needs to be done. And it
was it a list that kind of kept growing,
and growing. Yes, but at some point it stopped growing, and that's where we used as the jumping off point for where we would start. So they had that study for maybe 9 months before I joined the task force.
Mm-hmm.
And we call ourselves the Castle Keepers. And so we've had, since then, we had that engineering study tuned up a bit to match what we believe we can get done based on a feasibility study that we did.
Well, and finances.
For fundraising. For fundraising. So that's
how much do you need? Let me ask you, to fix the castle, to bring the castle up to contemporary building and every other conceivable kind of standard, what's the blank check?
$800,000.
That does not seem like much to me. It doesn't.
Right.
It literally doesn't.
Well, the church is who owns the building, and we have about 50 to 60 members. So
it's a small congregation.
Congregation. But we are mighty. There's over 400,000 that's been raised just from internal
You're
fundraising.
Kidding.
No.
So you're sort of almost halfway home.
Yeah. Yep.
But now is the time, if that's been the internal kind of thing, now is the time where you have to do a sort of serious outreach.
Yes.
To those concerts we were talking about, the John Devens concerts that have been held there, that's been a modest but effective fundraising tool, yes?
Yes. Yes. We've had some other success with donations through our website, Facebook. We are also expecting some good news from Beverly Bank soon. We believe that's going to be a pretty major gift, so that's good. We also had a major gift from a Lutheran church in Mount Greenwood that closed, and they had some funds from the closing.
So, Will, if and when, not if, when work starts, will it be able to be done relatively quickly, and will the building obviously would have to be closed to do it all at once, yes?
No, actually, we can remain open. It's all exterior work that's being done. So it's all on the stones and on the roof level. And so it'll remain open. There'll just be scaffolding on the exterior of the building. So it shouldn't affect it that much.
Errol, this must please you no end, huh?
Well, I'm really glad that something's going to be done to fix that castle. And all the proceeds from the sale of the book or the DVD, all of that is going to that restoration fund.
Now, I know that there's some lousy bookstores in Chicago that don't carry the book. I know you can get this at the Newberry Library.
Right.
Correct. Chicago's only castle. Can they order it online, too?
Yes, it's available through Bookies in Beverly. In fact, I think they told me that it was their best-selling book.
It wouldn't surprise me.
But
and there's a movie, too, right?
I remember. Yes, there's a film. Right, exactly.
You see, you have devoted a great deal of your professional life to this project.
I spent a year and a half for doing that film. Of course, I had a lot of help, and we just had a lot of fun doing that. And the book, Linda Lamberty was the editor of that book, and we actually had a lot of fun working on it. And it took a long time, but we finally got it done.
Well, it's a credit to you, and it's a credit to Beverly. It's an incredibly handsome book, and one that I actually wind up stealing from this book every time I write anything about Beverly or the neighborhood. And Linda did do a great job with helping you. We're going to continue this after the news, if you can. I just want to get to give people. And Roberta, this is on you, you know, websites to go to and offers that can be made and all that kind of stuff. So I will tell you, we'll get some news here. We can all relax for a second. That coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. CD is called A Solo Phone, Chicago by the Chicago Soul Jazz Collective. My two guests, my fascinating guests here, are Roberta Chalmers, who is a crucial member of the effort of the task force effort to save, resurrect, refurbish, and bring back to full healthy life Givens Castle, which is the title of Errol Magidson's book, Chicago's Only Castle. That it is, 103rd and Longworth Drive. If you're anywhere near Beverly, you'll find it. Don't let what happened to Errol happen to you, because Errol saw it the first time and has devoted half his life to telling its stories. There's some great stories. We talked about Robert Givens, this larger-than-life character who built the place. After he left, sold it, what happened to it?
Well, for a time, before he sold it, actually, the Chicago Female College, a secondary school for girls, was established by Thayer, And it was there for a couple years, and they prepared these young girls for college. Actually, it was a college preparatory course for the high, they said the higher colleges, including the University of Chicago. And after they were there, then the Burdett family lived in the castle. And J.B. Burdett was an inventor. He also worked with cars at the time, the steam cars.
Car and, races. Right.
He was involved in car races. In fact, he used a gasoline-powered car. But at the time, there were the steam-driven cars and the electric cars as well. So, and he and his wife, Jessie, they were in a major race, 1901, and they won that race from Chicago to Joliet in their division. So it was a pretty exciting time for them. And they,
how did it come into the possession of the church? How did that happen?
Well, Givens wanted to sell the castle. Oh, the church itself, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The church bought it in at the end of 1941. It was 1942. What happened was there was this one of the church leaders was living in the Beverly Morgan Park community, and she was trying to have services in her home because the church at that time was in Englewood, and it went under various names. But she was able to get the services in her home, and one day she was with the minister and his wife. They were driving down Longwood Drive. They looked up. They saw the castle, and somebody said, well, gee, I think that would make a fine church. And and she said, oh, yeah, well, I understand it's for sale. And they actually stopped the car, walked to the side door, or the front door, actually, one of them two, and knocked on it, and everything's history from that.
It holds not only a dear place in the hearts of people who grew up and still live in that neighborhood or visit friends in that neighborhood. It holds a fascination for, I think, the larger city, because in Open House Chicago, which is a yearly event that during which many buildings that are not open to the public do open to the public, and you see long lines in front of places like what used to be the Tribune Tower. What happened during last year's Open House Chicago down there?
Well, there were about 3,000 people who walked through that castle on that weekend, and that's an amazing number. That was the second most attended facility outside the downtown area.
Wow. I'm not surprised, though, because it really fascinates people. Roberta Chalmers, you were talking earlier about having now, as one means of fundraising, too, of having weekly tours starting?
Monthly
tours, yep. Sorry.
On the third Sunday of each month at 1 o'clock.
How do people discover that, and what's a website for people who want to start exploring your task force efforts?
Sure. So if people, we have many forms of ways they can find us, but so the website is givensbeverlycastle.org, and it's important that we know it's G-I-V-I-N-S. And Google will try to tell you it should be ENS, but it's not. If you prefer Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, we are Givens Castle on all three places. And there's donation links on the website and on Facebook. We would appreciate all donations. And if any major donors want to come our way, I am available at all times to talk.
Yeah, no, they really should, because as I said before, I don't mean to toss around, ooh, $800,000, not much. You know, when a guy like Ken Griffin, Illinois' richest guy, buys a apartment in New York for, you know, $280 million, $800,000 does not seem like a hell of a lot of money to save a unique building. there are public spaces there. Has the church, mm-hmm. with the success of John Devon's occasional concerts there, and these tours are probably going to do this too, I have the feeling, and both of you can tell me, that there may in the future be a way for this building to be shared with more of Chicago.
Yeah. Actually, we think of it as a community space anyway. We offer rentals of the castle. They can rent. We have actually two floors that are rentable. The first floor is kind of a meeting space or a ceremony space. And then the upstairs is can be like a banquet hall. And we've got a full-service kitchen. So it is available for community use.
Wow. And that could also, after this initial money and the renovations are done, that's an ongoing source of revenue that can, you know, be used to patch things. Errol Mackinson, where can people buy your book? I know they can get it at the great bookstore in the Newberry Library.
Well, the Bookies in Beverly has a special deal. It's also available on the internet through Amazon.
You can say Amazon. I know booksellers don't like it, but there are some people who can't leave their home. I mean, that's another thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I certainly am not recommending you buy everything from Amazon, but it is a fascinating book, and thanks to our mutual friend Linda Lamberty too. It's it is so, the research in here is so sound, you know, it really is, and the illustrations are remarkable. When this God, I would have loved this Givens guy, you know, when he went to Europe, he would write stories for the magazine, as if, for the newspapers, as if he was, you know, a travel writer.
Right, he was very funny. I mean, he wrote about when he was in London. This would be 1892. He writes about the elevators there, and he say they're just not like the elevators we have in Illinois. The bellboy runs up with your luggage up the stairs, and you're in the elevator. He's already up there with the luggage. He's already in your room. He's already lit the candles by the time you get there. But, of course, it was even worse at the Uffizi Museum in Florence when Givens visited that museum. Evidently, they didn't even have electric elevators. They had four people running the elevator with weights, so that when, you know...
could start something like that now, and it would be the hippest health club in Chicago.
They would take weights off. The bigger, the heavier the person was. So, and when Givens got on there, he was a pretty big man.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he weighed quite a bit, and they would say, "This a fatter man. You know, take off more weights."
Take it. Throw your shoes out there. I Roberta Chalmers and Errol Mackinson, and you too, Linda, over there. Shy, Linda. I so admire your efforts to do this, and I'm really pleased that you're sort of, in a way, halfway home. And if you start, because that's... And I'm sure that there are other, you know, you said something about the Beverly Bank, and there are other... I'm not from Beverly. I can't imagine that corner without that castle.
Right. Actually, BAPA, who is in support of our restoration and helps us, they actually have a little banner on their weekly emails that say, "No castle on the hill, unthinkable."
Is that right?
Yes, they do.
Good, good.
That's the Beverly Area Planning Association.
Right. Yeah, they have a weekly newsletter called The Villager. Yeah,
yeah, it's an amazing, I think, neighborhood, Beverly, and the surrounding. Where did, and also when you go down to the church, even if you go down to just look, Vicki Simmerling owns a fascinating, wonderful gallery about half a block east of the castle called the Heritage Gallery, where... If you want a piece of Beverly, her father, Jack Simmerling, was a great artist, and also a fascinating guy, too, and a sweetheart. And he did watercolors and drawings and sketches of virtually every building in Beverly and every home. If you're ever invited to a home in Beverly and you don't see a Jack Simmerling on the wall, you're in the wrong place. I mean,
right.
Really, you're in the wrong place. Do they now, there used to be a nice restaurant called Cafe 103. Is that gone now? It's gone. It went out. Yeah. See, that's, well, there are a lot of bars. There are a lot of bars and restaurants on Western Avenue, not far from the castle, where you can go after visiting the castle.
Yep.
So give me that website one more time.
It's givinsbeverlycastle.org, and okay. That's G-I-V-I-N-S.
And, Errol, where can people buy your book?
Well, Bookies in Beverly has a special deal for the book and the
Newberry.
The DVD. Yeah, the Newberry has it as in the library, but it's available on Amazon. Also, chicagosonlycastle.org, that's our website. That's chicagosonlycastle.org.
Well, it is wonderful to meet you, Roberta. I've known you for a while, and just, it's a pleasure for me to be with passionate Chicagoans.
Thank you.
And your piece of Chicago is at 103rd and Longworth Drive in the Beverly area. And if you're halfway home now, I'll do all I can to get you the rest of the way.
We really appreciate
that. I'm broke, so I can't do any, can't do anything on a personal level. I would just tell all the Game of Thrones people aren't listening now because they're watching the Game of Thrones. So
right.
I may have to try some different means to get to them. Maybe in 4 weeks when Game of Thrones is over.
Right.
I'm going to say congratulations. I know it's work is not done yet, and I know it's very energetic work, but I mean that really impresses me that you're halfway home, and it's a very, to my mind, very reasonable cost. I mean, mm-hmm. there are condominiums, you know, half a block from where we're sitting that cost more than $800,000.
Right.
A lot of them. Roberta, Aaron, Linda, thank you. And keep me posted,
yes,
will you please?
Yes, we will. Thank you very much for having
keep
us on.
Keep me posted. Let's take a break, and then we're going to talk to the great Fred Mitchell. It is my distinct pleasure to have an old friend and a man I have admired for many, many, many years on the phone with me now. It is Fred Mitchell, the prolific, intelligent sports writer. Fred, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. We are going to devote most of the rest of this show to talking about your latest book, The History of Loyola Basketball, More Than a Shot and a Prayer, but I would be terribly remiss, given your expertise in all things sports, not to ask you, what did you think of the Kentucky Derby yesterday, Fred Mitchell?
Well, I was watching like millions of other people, and the former sports writer in me came out, and my first thought was, boy, if I was there writing this story and having to change everything after the delay, how troubling that would have been. But in terms of actually what happened the way things changed at the end, I think they did the right thing. It certainly wasn't necessarily a popular thing to do.
That's for sure.
To say the least, right? But they said that this is something that they would have done if it had been a so-called ordinary race on a Wednesday, with the evidence that they had in front of them. It took so much time to look it over and to talk to the jockeys involved and everybody involved. And it seems like they did a responsible thing, even though it upset an awful lot of people.
On some level, and you can talk to this too, and we will. We're going to spend the whole half hour talking about your book, but I just, whenever, if I saw you on the street, I'd be asking you about the Derby.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, it's like, it seemed to me, and I'm a big, and always have been a big fan of thoroughbred racing, admiring the horses as athletes and the jockeys as athletes. And given the recent, the spate of deaths at Santa Anita, you know, something like 21 horses dying in 3 or 4 months, and the sort of overall image of thoroughbred racing, this almost sounded, felt to me like another nail in the coffin. Am I making too much of that, Fred, or do you think thoroughbred racing in this country is in trouble?
Well, certainly it is in trouble. And, as it relates to what happened in this Derby, after we saw the replays and the slow motion and all that, and we saw the horses, coming very, very close to
Yeah.
That could have been very tragic for a lot of people, the jockeys and the horses. And, you know, fortunately, it did not come to that. But, yeah, there's so much rightful attention about the treatment of horses and animals.
Yeah.
That would have been really tragic.
Yeah, and I think it came really, really close. Before we get to the news, I want to read a bit from the preface of, and again, Fred Mitchell's latest book, is The History of Loyola Basketball More Than a Shot in a Prayer? It is, I don't care how big a fan you are or how much time you devoted to reading stories in newspapers and magazines about this last year's, the 17-18 season's remarkable journey, you haven't read anything with the depth that Fred will show you in this book. And that is in part because, as he writes in the preface, growing up a Chicago sports fan and later becoming a Chicago sports writer afforded me an unobstructed view of the city's college and professional teams as they succeeded and failed. For four decades, I accrued enough, this is a great line, enough media credentials to decorate a Christmas tree. I was the only sports writer in Chicago Tribune history to be the main beat reporter covering the Cubs, Bears, and Bulls as a main assignment, but that was just for starters. We will talk all about this book after the news. Fred Mitchell, as I said at the outset here, is a newspaper man, for whom I have great, great admiration. And this book, The History of Loyola Basketball, More Than a Shot in a Prayer, is just, Fred, it is such a delightful read. And I know you cover, near the end of it, every single game of that remarkable year. And it brought me back. I mean, it took me back. It evoked, I didn't see every game, that's for sure. But it evoked what a special year that was, and we'll get into more detail after the news. So, Fred, you hang on, you listeners hang on, and we'll be back. Welcome back. That's from Solophone, Chicago Soul Jazz Collective. I'm Rick Kogan, and my guest for the rest of this show is my friend Fred Mitchell, one of the great sports writers in the last 40 years in this country, not just this city. We were lucky enough to have him in the city. His latest book is The History of Loyola Basketball, More Than a Shot and a Prayer. There were so many things, Fred Mitchell, about, and you had covered Loyola in some of your later years at the Tribune, but there were so many things that were compelling about that year. But I'm telling you something, what distinguishes the 180 so pages of this book is the way in which you put it in perspective. It was joyful for me to read about the 1963 Loyola team that you and I, both as teenage boys, remember so well. But I think, even with all the coverage of Loyola, a lot of people forgot. That was a seminal year and a seminal time. And an important time. You devote a whole chapter, chapter 3, to that. Could you talk about that for a while, Fred? I'm not sure many people or publishers, they'd say, oh, well, yeah, just put a little something in about 1963. You devote an entire chapter to it, and I think it's an extremely important chapter in the book.
Yeah, I do, too. Thank you, Rick.
Sure.
You know, as I was writing the book and thinking about the national championship that the Loyola team won in men's basketball in 1963, I came across so many other important things that happened, not just in sports, but social issues.
Yeah.
It was just really groundbreaking. It was a different era. And those of us of a certain age, you remember where you were when you heard things happening. President
October 22nd, yeah.
Kennedy,
November 22nd, yeah.
Yeah, Kennedy being assassinated. I remember sitting at a kitchen table with two classmates when we were having lunch right before heading back to school and looking at a black and white TV and just being, stunned at what we saw and heard there. 1963 also happened to be the year that the Bears won the Pro Football NFL Championship. This predated the Super Bowl, so the preeminent team in the NFL was playing in the NFL Championship game. And I was fortunate enough to attend that game with my father at Wrigley Field and froze to death. Still trying to thaw out from that game. But I remember, you know, every detail of that 14-10 victory by the Bears.
And I too, you know, one thing you told me that I did not know, you know, because we're roughly the same age, Fred, and I was thinking to myself, okay, I could sit here and tell a lot of things about 1963. One of the things I didn't know is that a guy named Michael Jordan was born on February 17th, 1963, which may go down someday as the biggest event of that year.
Exactly. Yeah, that kind of shocked me too. As I looked that up, and said, "Wow, that was quite a year, wasn't it?"
But the other thing about that year and what you do so remarkably well in this chapter, Fred, is it was a very, very different kind of racial environment, was it not? One that I think is very hard for people who weren't around then to even imagine, frankly.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, and you know, it was epitomized by what the African American players on the 1963 Loyola team had to endure and overcome, and the remarkable courage of the coach George Ireland, who dared to start four African American players on the basketball court. Like you say, it's hard to believe, but during that era, it was sort of a unspoken, unwritten gentleman's agreement among the white coaches that you don't put more than two African American players on the court at the same time.
Yeah,
and he did it, and they won. And like I said, they had to endure many indignities, and yet they persevered and went about their business, and not only, you know, won a championship on the basketball court, but all of the players on that 63 team not only graduated from Loyola, but I think there was a total of 21 degrees obtained by the members of that team over the years. Dick Rouse, who was the guy who tipped in the winning basket. He had like three master's degrees and a PhD by himself. So
yeah, I'll forgive Johnny Egan for becoming an attorney, but that's another matter altogether. But I think literally that is such an important chapter in this book, because you know they were getting threats from the Ku Klux Klan, for God's sake, and I think in their quiet way, for, you know, certainly myself as a teenager in that era, very, very excited about the victory, but in a very quiet way, they did those guys and that team did a lot for easing some racial strife, I think, just by the dignified way in which they went about their business.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, one of the hallmark games of that season was against Mississippi State.
Yeah.
And the quick story of it is that they were to play Mississippi State in the NCAA tournament in the early round game in Lansing, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor of Mississippi forbade the team from playing integrated teams. The players themselves wanted to, you know, they wanted to play basketball and they wanted to prove themselves. So they ended up, in the middle of the night, with their coach, flying in a private plane and defied the orders of the governor of Mississippi. Yeah. They played the game. Loyola won, of course, but it was a remarkable game. And I had a chance to interview players from both those teams about 5 or 6 years ago, and they talked about the impact that meeting had on their lives, not just their speech, but their entire lives.
This is a remarkable book, but that chapter just jumped out at me, as it will anybody. Anybody listening who was a teenager in the early 60s will just be, it's like a book in itself. But back to this team. Knowing this team and knowing this coach, before you left the Tribune, and you knew a bit about them and you watched them, could you ever, Fred Mitchell, have anticipated the run they would have in 17-18?
No, not so soon, certainly. Like you said, I covered his teams in 2014 and 15, and Porter Moser, the coach, was very earnest and sincere about creating a winning culture. So he constantly talked about that, and recruiting players from winning programs, guys who were good students as well, and good character guys. And, you know, it all sounded well and good at that time, and you just felt then that, well, they're not going to be able to win a major championship going that route. So to see them actually do that and get to the Final Four,
amazing!
Doing it the right way. I mean, you couldn't write a fantasy fictional.
No, it's like it was. I mean, it literally was like the college version of Hoosiers or something. I mean, I it was flabbergasting on every level and terribly, terribly, terribly exciting. Another thing you do in this book, Fred Mitchell, and the book again is The History of Loyola Basketball, More Than a Shot in a Prayer. It basically is focused on the astonishing winning streak, but it does take in the whole gamut of things. We just talked about Chapter 3, about the 1963 win set against the backdrop of a tumultuous year, but also some incredible racial strife. You write here, too, Fred, in, I think this might be Chapter 2, I'm going through this, but you write, Loyola's success in 2017-18 revived hope that the Chicago area basketball programs could indeed take center stage among the nation's elite. And then you do a very nice job of talking about how this place, and reminding me in some ways, used to, good Lord, this was a breeding ground for great talents, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so many star players that I covered way back at the beginning of my Tribune career when I was covering high school sports, and saw players like Isaiah Thomas,
Mark Aguirre,
Doc Rivers, on and on, Terry Cummings, all of these guys who went on to have stellar NBA careers, and yet most of these guys escaped Chicago, with the exception of McGuire and Cummings.
Yeah,
there's just been so much talent in Chicago, and it's you know, sad that we have not had very many winning teams.
Yeah, it's because, well, you know, part of it is, you know, the prestige. College basketball has gone very, very strange to me, you know, especially the one and out, the one and done kind of thing that's going on. And, you know, you look at, you know, Zion. I would love to have watched, as I did, you know, Bill Walton play 4 years at UCLA. I would have loved to have watched Zion Williamson play 4 years at a college. Can you even imagine? That would have been something. I don't begrudge him leaving because he's automatically set for life, but wow, that's something that I think made college basketball so exciting in the day. Do you agree with that, Fred, or not?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that, and it's and you know, and in a strange way, it probably made it possible for Loyola to get to the Final Four, because they don't have the one and done guy. So you've got guys playing 4 years, you get that senior leadership.
Yep.
You get the guys playing as a unit and respecting which, you know, contribution each guy can make and fit in. So that probably made that more possible than it would be otherwise.
No question.
But I agree that it's unfortunate that you don't have more players playing three or four years.
Yeah, it was exciting when they did. I mean, Bill Walton is never my favorite basketball player, man, but when he was a senior at UCLA, he was, and, you know, Al Cinder, for God's sake. Fred, we got to take a little commercial break, and then I want to come back and talk about you know, maybe she wasn't a player, but she certainly was a star of that year. And I want to get some insight. I want to give you my impression of Sister Jean, and then I want yours. So we'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I've never enough time with Fred Mitchell, but I'll use it as energetically as I can. We're talking about his book, The History of Loyola Basketball, More Than a Shot and a Prayer. It is more than the history of Loyola basketball. It's a book of, it's only 180 pages, but it's a book of great depth and understanding, which you would expect from Fred after 40 years as a great sports writer here. Before we get to the woman who graces the cover of the book, and I'm sure you all can imagine who that is, Fred, do you think that the coach, Peter Mosier, has, even though he's getting nibbles, I was very pleased that he turned down, I guess it was a St. John's offer or something, at, you know, some grotesque figure of, you know, $5 million or something. Do you think he's built a program here that could be a consistent March Madness player?
I do, Rick. And, you know, it takes a commitment from the entire university and athletic department and everybody on board. And that's so important to him. I know that a new practice facility is being built. It's supposed to be ready, I think, in August. That Alan Norville, who was a former player back in the late 50s at Loyola, has become a very wealthy and successful businessman and has contributed a lot of his resources. So he's the main guy behind this new practice facility. So they need to, you know, have the facilities to help attract prominent high school players. And they can, I believe, become similar to other mid-majors like Butler, yep, and Gonzaga and schools, mm-hmm, of that size. Nice.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that, and I'm also glad, and obviously it solidifies his place at Loyola. When he, I can't remember, I may be wrong, was it St. John's, or he got a big offer, right?
Yes, yes. Yes, it was a long-term, 17 or 18, some crazy number.
Yeah, crazy, crazy.
and it just, you know, you hear a lot of rhetoric and cliches from a lot of coaches, but in this case, He really stepped up and did what he said.
Yeah.
And said that you don't have to have all the money in the world to be rich. And he said a friend of his told him that don't run away from happiness. And he said, I'm very happy here at Loyola, and that's great to see.
Yeah, I thought it was great to see in this crazy, crazy sports era. Now, on to the cover girl of your book. Sister Jean intrigued me, but one of the and I learned a great deal about her from your book, not so much from media coverage of her, because I think a lot of the media coverage wound up kind of turning her into a caricature of sorts. This is a human being, is it not?
Yes. And the thing is that she was the chaplain of the Loyola basketball team since 1994.
Right.
This is not somebody who jumped on the bandwagon just last year, you know, when they went to the Final Four. And she's provided so much, you know, Porter Moser referred to her as the team's comfort blanket.
Yeah.
And she's somebody who connects well with not only the basketball players, but also all the students who are not necessarily athletes. And, you know, she sends text messages to each one of the players and the coaches after every game, win or loss.
Yeah,
you know, go get them next time, or watch out for this guy next week. That kind of thing. So she is totally involved. And you know, for your listeners who may not know, she's 99 years old.
Yeah,
she'll turn 100 on August 21st. She's still very vibrant and clear minded, and I've enjoyed being in her presence. Book signing, and she's very sharp.
Well, the great thing, I get that sense from your book too, that you treat her not as a curio, but as a as what she is, a real fascinating human being. That's another aspect of your book, Fred, that I really love. This book, again, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure it's available at any site you might want to go to. I don't know if you're doing any signings coming up, Fred, or no.
Yes, we're planning to. We had one already at Loyola. I would say that both Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com make it available, and my Twitter handle is at Kicker34.
That's right.
And I was a kicker.
Yes, you were.
So, when we plan our next book signing, I'll certainly
let me know. Let me know, and I'll let the listeners know too. Because it's really a great, you've written a lot of books, Fred Mitchell, and you've written, God, tens of thousands of newspaper stories. You're now involved with the Blackhawks as a community correspondent working for Rocky Wirtz, who is a fascinating guy. And you want to know something interesting? Rocky Wirtz and I played football against one another in high school.
Wow!
Yeah, tell him I knocked him on his behind. No, I couldn't. He was a lineman, and I was a tiny, 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 tiny halfback both ways. Fred, I miss seeing you, but nobody goes in the office anymore at the Tribune anyway. So who cares? Who cares? I cannot tell you how much I like this book, The History of Loyola Basketball: More Than a Shot and a Prayer. It's 180 pages of very exciting reading, but also of reading of great depth. Fred, it's always great to talk to you. Love to your wife and Cameron.
All right. I appreciate it so much.
My pleasure. Always. Always. What a decent, good guy. And really was. I mean, if you've read newspapers in this town, he was and also a real gentleman. You know, no cheap shots, none of that jazz. We got to get a commercial break in, and then we will say good night to all of you fine people. Well, thank you all for listening. Thanks, Ben Anderson, for producing. Thanks, Dan Long, for engineering.